Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your host today will be Xander Kegg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do us the honors and introduce his guest this hour.
That's right on. Thank you so much for introducing the podcast. And let's go ahead and introduce our guest. So our guest today is Kevin Waldman. Kevin is the founder of PsychForm. It's a psychological research lab. It's actually launching its website today. So that's September 19th, 2025, when it was launched. It's at psychform.com. We'll be talking more about PsychForm. He's also a graduate student in clinical psychology at Northwestern University. I first learned about you, Kevin, because somebody sent me a link to a video where you were talking about toxic empathy. And I was immediately curious about you and your experience and this topic, which I'd never heard before. And so I'm so glad that you agreed to come on the Umbrella Hour to talk to us today. So welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hi, thank you. So good to be here.
Can we just jump right in to start? What is toxic empathy? I know we're not going to spend the whole hour talking about it, but I'd love to just have you give us some background on why did you start talking about this? What was happening in your world?
So I actually went to college later in life. And so I went to the University of Michigan at 33 years old. And I had never heard these buzzwords before. I've had a normal life, I thought, until I realized I hadn't. And so I started to see this radicalized empathy designed, I think, systematically into the curriculum at Michigan. The reason that we met is because I wrote an article in the Chicago Tribune about radical empathy, which is just another way of saying it. And it was because I witnessed certain conversations in Dearborn, Michigan after October 7th. I drove to Dearborn to do a little bit of research on what was happening because the campus turned into complete chaos with terrorists, essentially, from Dearborn on the campus. And so I learned about their approach to overtaking the University of Michigan campus by using what they were referring to as radical empathy. And that's how that journey started. And the podcast that you heard me talking on was with an expert on this. And I actually got a lot out of this because I should say I've learned that one of the important factors while discussing this topic is to explain that toxic or radical empathy is not empathy. It's just a buzzword to explain that it is a weaponized version of society's way of using guilt to get people to get on board with ideological extremism. And it works. It works extremely well, actually. And so especially with privileged young people in college campus settings, it's proven to be extremely effective. So that's how you and I met. And it's been a journey ever since. That was less than a year ago. And I've learned quite a bit since about it and met many experts. So yeah.
Yeah. I've definitely heard of the concept of weaponized compassion.
Yeah.
And in addition to guilt, also just as a shame tactic.
Yeah.
Which that's not new to me. I remember in the 1990s, I was there at the very beginning of the development of an organization called Queer Nation. And I was at their first public meeting. And I became actually a leader within one of their cells, as they called them, in Northern California. And we used shame as a tactic. We literally would surround people who came into the Castro, which is like the gay neighborhood in San Francisco, to gay bash or to treat gay people poorly in the neighborhood. We would surround them and we would point and we'd say, shame, 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 shame. It is an effective technique, but I think there's one thing to bring attention to somebody who is engaging in a verbally or physically aggressive or abusive behavior versus people who just hold contrary to whomever ideas or beliefs.
Yeah.
Well, because that's just the way it is. We live in a pluralistic society and people are going to have different beliefs. And we come from the quote unquote LGBT community from different parts of it. But still, I think that there is a tendency or at least an attempt to coerce all people who happen to be a gay or a lesbian or a bisexual or trans person to adhere to a very specific set of beliefs and points of view. And is that some of what you were bumping up against in when you were
Absolutely.
In college?
Absolutely. There's a very scripted narrative for LGBT people, and it's all rooted, I can say this confidently, the word all. It's in the academic setting, it's all rooted in this oppression narrative. Victimhood is a huge part of it, and a lack of equality. And so as a gay man who doesn't necessarily agree with this, I've learned that speaking against this orthodoxy results in my own community, not people my age, but people in that younger cohort, saying that I'm part of the problem because I'm a self-loathing gay or I'm a homophobic gay, which is absolutely absurd. I believe that the research that I do is to help gay and trans people by underscoring certain realities. And that's that we all have a different perspective. And that as long as you're not harming somebody, your perspective is valid and it doesn't have to align with mine. Also, lived experience, it's interesting with the LGBT community in academia, you're not even giving these kids a chance to breathe and understand their own life experience. You're telling them, this is how your life is going to operate if you identify in this way. And it is a negative experience, and you need to fight for equality. Give the kid a chance to experience their own life and their own identity before you're trying to bring them down and make them feel oppressed. When, I'm sorry, but if you're a student at the University of Michigan, you're just not oppressed. You're just not. So, I mean, you could be maybe in your hometown, but you are equal. And in many cases, LGBT people are lifted up in that community. I go to Northwestern with a scholarship. I went to Michigan with a scholarship, all because I wrote about being gay and they were seeking me out. And I'm not saying that that's not a great thing. I'm saying, let's reevaluate your actual identity based on your experience, not what you're being told. And so it just seems very scripted and orthodoxy to me. It's illuminating.
What we have in common is that we went to college when we were in our 30s. I was also 31 years old when I went to college, but yeah, that was in the 1990s. And I remember at the time, we would make fun of what we called the Oppression Olympics, because they were starting to show up. The postmodern topics were starting to come in. The queering of things was starting to come into some of my classes, not all of them. And we would joke about it. We would be like, okay, who's going to win the Olympics for oppression points? Those of us, at least within my campus, I was working in the GLBT Student Services Office. Again, this was the mid-1990s in Denver, Colorado. I founded a student organization for LGBT students. So I was in student government. I wasn't just some rando on campus. I was involved in things and we poked fun at it. It didn't extend beyond the college campus back then. It was primarily within the academy. And you said something about you're not oppressed, you know, if you're here. It makes me think of, and I'm blanking on his name, I really apologize, but he came up with this concept of luxury beliefs. And it's this idea that a foster kid who went into the Air Force, and then after he got out of the Air Force, he went off to one of the Ivy League schools on the GI Bill and was just confronted in a very glaring way about just the assumptions that people had around him about people and life and circumstances. And he's described them now as luxury beliefs, and he's written a book about it.
That's interesting. I should read that.
Absolutely, because I think there's something to, we used to say the bubble, or now they might say the echo chamber, or whatever it is. It's when you're only around people who maybe grew up in the same neighborhood as you, or same class, or same church. It's easy to feel everybody thinks this way, or everybody feels this way. And it's only when you step outside. For me, that was transitioning, right? Because I was lesbian in college and when I was in the military also. So that 20 years ago, when I started my transition, that's when it hit me. Oh, wait a minute. All of that stuff that I learned through the rhetoric around gender in the academy didn't have much application out in the real world.
Right.
And that's when I started to question more. I was already sort of on that edge, but I started to question more, like, wait a minute, something's not right here. Were they lying? Were they misinformed? Was it just a thought exercise? Yeah. So I don't know if that'll come up later, but I thought I'd add that in. You did mention something about we should be free to believe and think in the ways as long as we're not harming people. Now, of course, I know, and I'm sure you know, because you're observant and you're also a student of clinical psychology, that this is a very interesting thing, this idea of harm, because people will say, you're committing emotional violence toward me, and that's harming me because of the way you're talking, the words you're using, or the ideas you're espousing. And so what would be a way to maybe counter the claim that having a different, even if it's not oppositional, even if it is oppositional, that it's not harmful It just might be uncomfortable or
Yeah.
unwanted.
I think that the way to do that is to just prepare people for expecting that to happen. So we're seeing now in education, which it'd be interesting if we could sit down and actually compare notes on the 90s versus today on what we were learning, because I am now at Northwestern, which is one of the most prestigious universities in America. It is an affirmation-only model in psychology, meaning we only affirm what a person in crisis tells us. We never challenge by any means. And so we do learn confrontation techniques, but they're really just to keep a conversation afloat. It's not really about challenging the person's identity in any way. And so, what I'm learning through doing research based off of the books, based off of the lectures, is that this is probably contributing to it because we see in society, especially in young people, an inability to even function through a conversation where they believe the other person disagrees with them because they are being told at a developmental part of their life that that person is harming them instead of just experiencing their own life. This is why at PsychForm, we have access to thousands of students now, and we're learning when you cut away what you're supposed to be performing in front of a professor, what do you actually believe about these polarizing topics? And most people take a minute, they don't know because they're so used to the script and they're so used to this performative virtue signaling, this performative victimhood, and they actually don't know what they believe. All they know is that if somebody believes that a man and a woman are the ones who should be getting married, that person is Hitler, basically. And I'm like, listen, I don't agree with this person, but they are not harming you or me by believing that. One of the reasons why this is important today is because we have violence occurring because of this at this point on campuses. And it's because people are genuinely afraid of the opposing viewpoint. It's not so much as I don't want to be in a room with this person. It's this person could kill me. And this is not a reality to me or you. I've actually had hardship and because of being gay, and I've gotten past it, and now I have resilience as an adult. This is what needs to occur for all young people of all identities, and this is something that we're taking away from them by telling them that everything is something to fear if you don't understand it.
Absolutely. I would imagine there aren't very many children who are growing up with the sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. I remember we used to say things when people would rattle off statements, we would say, oh, it sounds like a bumper sticker slogan. Now they're memes, right? It's just a different way of communicating. I could tell my boohoo story of being locked up in a psychiatric hospital for a year as a teenager and put through conversion therapy. So what? I basically figured out how to make a game of it. And clearly it didn't work because not only did I continue to be a lesbian, then I transitioned, and now I'm a trans man. So it didn't take whatever they were attempting to do. But we're not going to go into detail on this. But for the listener, I think it might be important for them to know that there is a difference between having an internal versus an external locus of control and how much that's happening in the outside world, regardless of how, where it is in that concentric circle, close to you or far away from you, how you let it impact you. And so there are people who just, we don't want to be narcissists where we don't care at all and nothing bothers us. But on the other side, if we're just walking pincushions that are constantly letting people poke at us and just stick us with their little pins and we walk around with them. Somewhere in between, we want to get to a place of cultivating in young people, young children, how you build resiliency. What are the skills of that? That could be a whole nother workshop. I would imagine we'll be talking about things like that. And the next time you and I are on a podcast together, which will be with Braver Angels Mental Health Professionals Forum, that's going to be more the place to talk about. People might ask questions about that.
Really quick, I do think though that Jonathan Haidt's work, where he's trying to rid schools of devices and get kids off social media, is part of the solution. This issue with control, people believe, myself included, I see something happen. We see anything the second it happens because there's always someone recording it and going live on Instagram or on TikTok or whatever. And getting rid of that connection, which is not going to happen, by the way. We have to learn to live in a society where we have instant access, but we have to learn how to differentiate between what we're actually involved with and what we're just viewing. And I think that that's a challenge that we've all had to learn the hard way. And I've had to learn it myself. But anyway, yeah.
I'm not on social media, so I don't see those images and I don't watch them. Even when clips circulate and people send them directly to me in a text, did you see this? I don't watch it. And the reason for that is I remember watching over and over and over again people diving out of the World Trade Center on 9/11. I was watching that live. I was watching the TV when the second plane struck the building. I was on the East Coast and I was up, and somebody had called and said, turn on the TV. And they played that over and over and over again for weeks, maybe months. I think it was damaging, right? I think the O.J. Simpson trial, where it was the first big trial where you got to see the proceedings as they played out day after day after day. When we went into that kind of world where we were seeing everything in real time, I think there's many different ways in which that's impacted people. And so I may have made the choice to not be on social media beyond maybe two. They're not those typical ones like Instagram and TikTok and X, and I'm not on any of those. I never have been. For me, that's a protective factor. For my own well-being, I don't view that stuff. Now, I know people who have to view it because it's part of their job, because they write, they report, they study. But I would hope that they've developed the skills, like you've mentioned, but the skills to separate, to create distance, and to compartmentalize, and all the things that we can do on that short-term basis. We don't want to permanently be desensitized and compartmentalized, but we can use those as good protective factors, as tools and strategies to be able to live our life and not be consumed by fear and anxiety, thinking that a person with an opposite or very different view from us wants to physically expunge our life. You know what I mean? That's a very sad to live in that reality. Let's talk about PsychForm. I'm really excited to hear about how you got that started. What are your goals with it? What are you doing? Let's hear all about PsychForm.
So today we are launching our website, and it should be up by this evening. There's a few little kinks to figure out, but so I started PsychForm as a result of exactly what we're talking about. And I realized that many of the issues that we're discussing are a result of the real cancer, which is the adults on college campuses that are creating this curriculum that is resulting in all of these mental health crises. And so I started doing research on my own at the University of Michigan, and I didn't have a name for it at that point. And then I met my now the director of PsychForm, which is Forrest Rahm, who went meeting her was the turning point for me in terms of I can actually make this work because I've got a partner to do it with. And because two voices are so much better than one when it comes to these polarizing topics and shedding light on things like gender and politics in general and mental health, it's so hard to be heard because we're discussing. If I say something about anything trans and it's not the narrative, it's I'm somehow Hitler or I want people to be put in camps. And when really my work is to help understand that these broad umbrella terms are actually doing harm to people that are actually just experiencing gender dysphoria, it's not a social thing for them. It's not fashionable. It's a lifestyle and it's a mental health thing. And it's something that they really need to focus on, not wear as a badge of my social identity. And this is just a broad example of what we do at PsychForm is we interview thousands of students, asking them to explain what they really believe about these things in order to differentiate between what's real and what they're being told. So it's really focused in students explaining performance to us, where we have them explain on various topics. We have six studies currently in the works, but the one that went viral that got 20 million views, which is so crazy. I wrote an article in The Hill about it, and it got 20 million people, I guess, all over the internet reading it. And it was about students admitting that 88% of students that we interviewed at the University of Michigan and at Northwestern admit that they're performing liberal views. And these people are liberal, most of them, but they're going overboard in order to get good grades because the professors are doing this narrative where if you are not extreme left, you are somehow going to be a part of the problem that is America. And so I actually just at a boiling point couldn't take it anymore and started to put these surveys together and interview students. And now I'm, let's make a business out of this. And it turns out, especially after the one went viral, we can't even keep up with the amount of people, especially professors, that want us to do this research. Because what we've learned is that this is shocking. The professors are also confessing that they're performing. And these are liberal women that do gender studies at Columbia, at Penn, and they're like, we started this train and now we're not allowed to get off of it. It doesn't mean they're an extreme right-wing gun holding. It means they're just somebody who sees the problem. We had somebody email us saying, I have to explain to my own daughter that what I'm teaching is not actually scientific or biological. And it's gone too far because now their 13-year-old daughters, well, it's my turn to transition and they're not trans. So what we're doing now is we're trying to explain our results, which are still in the works, but it's basically saying they're being taught this, the reality is this. And I think that making the students perform to this level of any side of orthodoxy, it doesn't mean it matter if it's left or right, it's creating mental health issues in the country. And it's preventing those who are actually suffering from getting help because there's such a broad window here of people who want to be a part of this community, which is sickening to what we think of as something that's mental health crisis, me and you. They think of it as an identity. I want that to end. I'm sick of this. And I realized that the way to do this is not for me personally to do activism. That's not me. It's to provide data. Let's get the data. Let's prove that the students are over this. And by the way, they might not be. So we're working on it. But to my knowledge, what we've got so far is the students are very liberal people, but they're sick of this narrative, this script of this very far leftist. I mean, these are kids that are being told that you can kill somebody, essentially. I mean, I'm generalizing, but they understand why Charlie Kirk was killed and they're vouching for the reason, but that somehow Jimmy Kimmel or whatever losing his show is somehow fascism. This is the result. It's a very disconnected from reality generation. And I think our data on these polarizing topics is going to help give voice to a more realistic approach to the future of education.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Keg and his guest, Kevin Waldman, founder of PsychForm, a psychological research lab. Kevin is discussing toxic empathy. We are always grateful to our sponsors and therefore grateful to play their commercials. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You're listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Keg and his guest, Kevin Waldman, founder of PsychForm, a psychological research lab. Kevin is discussing toxic empathy. Let's get back to the show.
I think our data on these polarizing topics is going to help give voice to a more realistic approach to the future of education.
I had wondered if there was a large cohort of people in the academy, not just students, but the academics, who were also parroting.
Yeah.
Belonging is central. It's key to human existence.
Yes.
It's the way we're wired. And the last thing you want is to become ostracized from your department, from
right.
your classmates, from your, right? That's not what you want. And
right.
it might start out innocently enough by agreeing that, Yeah, of course gay people should be able to get married to each other. But then it keeps going and going and going. And they're like, if those people who told me that that was right are now telling me this is right, they think it's just the natural progression. It right. does remind me, we had Jonathan Rauch on the show a few months back, and he's a gay man. He works at the Brookings Institute, and he was part of a cohort of mostly gay men, some lesbian women in the 1990s that wrestled away the movement for civil and legal rights from the queer community. So there was the queer rights movement and then the gay rights movement. I think what ended up happening is after following Stonewall riots, the gays and the queers intermingled out of necessity. And then as time progressed, you could see the widening gap between those in our community who were like, the nuclear family is oppressive and the military is a killing machine, and that, right, they were capitalism is abhorrent. And then you had the other people in our community who were like, I want to get married. I want to have a family. I want to live in a neighborhood. I want to serve right. my country. I want to be able to dine and lodge without being denied entry into those places. And so they took over, Jonathan Rauch, Andrew Sullivan, some others, and they started articulating this argument that no, we do want those things. And then they came. We got those legal measures and protections. We got the social acceptance pretty broadly. And I think what ended up happening is then those people that we had separated from, I would count myself, I was at the time part of Queer Nation and Lesbian Avengers and recognizing, oh, wait a minute, I was also raised Catholic. Of course, marriage is important. And I was a veteran at the time already. Of course, we should be able to serve in the military. I was out of step yeah. with those queer organizations, those more radical organizations, and found myself migrating more to the middle. You know, that's kind of where I stay most of the time. When Jonathan was on the show, I said, I feel like we need to do that again. We need a very loud liberal slash moderate slash whatever element of our community to reestablish itself very yeah. publicly and say, no, those things are not what the majority of us want. Just like the majority of us didn't want to abolish the nuclear family and the military and capitalism. And so those same kinds of messages are coming in more on the trans stuff now. And so it does bother me a little bit that LGB people are going off on their own and they're leaving us all in the dust because they don't have the time or the bandwidth or the interest necessarily to sort us out. I get it. For those who still would like to work more in a coalition format, there are plenty of us that are willing to do that. Really quickly, I wonder about the professors. I wish they would do what a lot of professors have done over the last few years. I wish they would get involved with Heterodox Academy and yeah. team up with their colleagues around the nation. Social work has started to do that, right? I'm a licensed clinical social worker. There's a social work group within Heterodox Academy, and these are academics and students, and their papers have just now started to be published that they've been working on for 3, 4, 5 years. And it's clear that there's enough of them coming out saying the orthodoxy that has taken over social work education programs needs to change. It doesn't need to stop. Sure, talk about postmodernism in addition to all the other lenses.
Yeah, and I think that Heterodox Academy, which I recently joined, I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes. I'm so impressed. And because I agree with what you're saying about the community in general, I think fear is a big part of it. I am very afraid of our community thinking that we're so afraid of cancel culture in this world. People don't understand what actual research, what investigative work is. It's asking hard questions. That doesn't mean anyone's bigoted. It just means that there's clearly a chaos happening right now in our community. And it's time to figure out what's real. And I'm starting to see some semi-well-known people start deciphering verbally the issues with the queer community versus gay community. And I like seeing that actually, because it's not my job or responsibility to do that. I just identify as just a gay man. I do live in Boys Town in Chicago. It's very gay here. But I see things that are so different than when I was younger in the gay bars. I don't even go to them really anymore. Because it's women everywhere. And I do see that as a queer community thing. And I think that it's, in a way, disrespectful to the gay community. This is just a general personal statement, but I'm not saying there's something wrong with it. I'm saying when a girl's hammered in my face thinking that I'm going to be her gay best friend because I'm there, or they're in the bathroom and it's just chaos, they're totally invading the space because they're identifying as queer. And are you even queer, or did you just want someone fun to hang out with? These are things that are really frustrating people. I don't focus on any of this though, but I'm seeing professionally, this is not my thing. I just see it socially and I'm like, wow, it must be interesting to be 22 right now because all these straight women identifying as queer. And then you get the queer individuals who seem to be very activist cult mindset. I wonder where the happiness is. I had my spaces in my 20s, gay bars, gay friends, where we just felt alone and protected in a good way, community alone. I mean, I knew when I walked into a gay bar in New York in 2007 that I was going to be around a bunch of gay men from all over that got me. And this is not the case today. So I just feel bad for them. There's so much weighing on these gay kids now that they have to identify as all these things. They have to fight for all these causes. But who are you? Yeah. What gay are you? Like, what version of this are you? Do you even know? And I think that's what my focus, especially at Psych Forum, is about, which is as an individual, when you take away all of these causes, who are you?
So the name is Psych Forum. Is FORM, is that an acronym for something?
Yeah, Foundations of Reason and Meaning. Yeah.
Okay. And you said you have several different research projects. Did you say like six or something?
Yeah. So right now, our first one that went viral is the first full complete one on my website. And we're doing peer review for that now, which is great because that's incredible. Then we're doing one on students, just asking students to explain how they feel about certain polarizing topics. So like Islam, transgender visibility, activist culture. Charlie Kirk now is a study that we just got asked to do, which is about political violence. It's exciting. It's going to be really cool. Yeah, so that's what we're doing now. And now you can also go to our website and ask us to put together a study for you if you're a professor, which is something that we have quite a decent demand for, I believe.
Fantastic. What kind of reception are you getting from your other grad student colleagues, your classmates?
It's been a roller coaster. Most people think it's pretty epic what we're doing. But if you are of the mindset of what we're trying to prove, they're very offended by certain questions. I mean, to even ask a question, if you've been in academia for 30 years and you are one of the people that are peddling this narrative that we're trying to question respectfully, I think it's nerving for them to see that this is potentially going to be something that is now unavoidable, which is that the students do not agree with what they're putting in their essays and their exams. And so the reception's been pretty good. We have many, many professors behind the scenes egging us on, mentoring us, championing this cause. We have people from all over the country who have reached out, and we have people that are going to help this business move forward, I believe. It's in the infancy. She's a baby business right now. But I think that if we are persistent with this, this could be a game changer for our field in psychology. The goal for me and Forrest, who are the two main people doing the work, is to have the curriculums change. Go back to a narrative where everyone can bring their viewpoint instead of this one single topic.
Yeah, because I'm thinking in a training program for clinicians or even researchers, where within psychology, there are so many theoretical orientations and so many different intervention models. And to say that somehow you must conform all of them to this one narrative. Oh, you can be psychodynamic, but you must be affirmative, or you can believe in solution-focused models. There's so many different options for people. Our theoretical orientations come from our curiosity and our default personality setting and our life experience and the way we perceive the world, right? And then within each of those orientations are a variety of intervention models that we might utilize based on the population we're serving or the setting in which we're serving in. To say to just forget all of that, that to me seems to be a disservice, not just to the students, but to all of the occupations that are impacted by psychology as a root, like social work, but also to just, I was going to say, to deny the foundation of the field. But maybe that's the point. Maybe there is an intention to deny the foundation of psychology developed through Freud and Jung. And maybe that is part of the goal. I don't know. I find it really interesting. It's sort of like if you were taking a literature appreciation class and you were told you can only read literature through this one lens, which is critical. You can't apply any other lens when you're reading it, just the one, versus the way they used to teach it, which is you can read it this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, and talk about the different interpretations based on the different lens that you read it through, that makes more sense to me than what is happening now. This very narrow, you must use this model or look at people through this lens.
And the thing is, you'd be surprised at how what you're saying, the students agree with you. And that's what we're going to use this data to illuminate to the general public, which is what you're saying is exactly what people are wanting, and they just don't have the ability to speak up and say it. And we're going to provide that voice for them to say, we even are using some of the curriculum, especially in the psych department, and asking the students very simple questions. Do you think this is extremism? And the answer is usually yes. But it's strange to me and it's concerning that the administration and the board, these people are so powerful. And I will never publicly use names because I'm afraid, but they are creating this as an unstoppable force. And I think that what you're talking about right now is what the students want. People like us who are able to provide some sort of service to them to help, that we continue to do that, even if it's challenging at the beginning phases, because the result is going to be hopefully a little bit of change, which is all I really want to see happen. Of course, a lot would be great, but it's never going to happen that way. Yeah. I think that what you're saying is exactly what many people, thousands, literally believe. And it's just, how do you actually put that into practice is the question, which I don't have the answer yet.
One of the things I would imagine could happen is, in response to your research, those are just anonymous opinions. Those are where's your proof? You could be fabricating that. Why am I not hearing this on campus? And we say, well, people are afraid of what? What are they afraid of? I think there is the denial. I think you have two groups of people that make a similar claim. I'm afraid to share my views because of the reaction I might get. I would imagine you've got far right and far left people who would say the same thing as to why they don't share outwardly in certain settings. It's one of those things where you're like, well, okay. I mean, I guess there must be some people out there who think this way and have this experience. But I think it really helps when we can know more.
Yeah.
Who, where, when, how.
You know what's interesting though, Xander, is that now that I started PsychForm, it's my own LLC, and we're going to turn it into a nonprofit, I'm sure, eventually. It's already been discussed. I own the rights to the data, which means I can use names now. Those who are willing. So there will be, on all these forms that the kids fill out, there will be a part that says, do you want to add your name? I mean, they do give us their names. Depending on the study, we ask for certain identifying characteristics. But now that it belongs to PsychForm, we can say, let's get some quotes with your name. Let's get you on camera to discuss these things. Let's just hope the next year we get that going, because I think that that's where we're headed. So give me a year, but I think in the next couple of months, we'll get some students on record.
Absolutely. I would hope that there would be some sort of support or assistance from Heterodox Academy to help with that endeavor, because I think it's really important. It's one thing to know that there's a bunch of people out there who think and feel a certain way. I think it's what helped the gay rights movement for people. It wasn't just some gay person out there. Oh, my cousin, my bank teller, or my real estate agent, the taxi driver, whatever. When we made people aware that, yeah, I'm here, this is who I am, and I'm living my life, it allowed people to have a real world experience. And then it's harder to dismiss, especially I hope some of these professors get up the gumption to, because there are so many professors who have, and they reap the consequences, but they feel free. As a result of doing it. And I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
So Kevin, this is not just something that we're experiencing here in the United States. And I'm wondering, are you familiar with efforts in other parts of the world similar to PsychForm? Do you have any intention of expanding beyond the United States?
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to Xander Keg and his guest, Kevin Waldman, founder of PsychForm, a psychological research lab. Kevin is discussing toxic empathy. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly after we play our sponsor's commercial.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased. naked, drowning, losing teeth? What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Xander Kegg and his guest, Kevin Waldman. Kevin is the founder of PsychForm, a psychological research lab, who is discussing toxic empathy. Let's get back to the show.
This is not just something that we're experiencing here in the United States. And I'm wondering, are you familiar with efforts in other parts of the world similar to PsychForm? Do you have any intention of expanding beyond the United States?
So we have heard from a couple organizations overseas. And right now, since we're so focused on just like the five main institutions here in Chicago, which is where we started all this, we're just staying national. And I know for a fact, though, that overseas is going to be happening for us because they're actually more willing to just fly us out there, because I think that in some cases, they're more desperate over there than they are here, especially when it comes to our studies that we're doing focused on immigration. So also gender, we've been invited to do a couple things overseas for next year. So stay tuned for that. I'll keep you in the loop for that, because these conferences are what I think will lead to some momentum. To answer your question, I'm not really sure where we're going to go with this. For now, we're staying in the United States and going to give it a year and see how it goes. But it would be great to expand this overseas.
I'm sure there's plenty to keep you busy.
I know, there really is.
Okay, so we have a couple of minutes left. Let's have you give us some information. Where can people find you? Where are some of your articles published? What are some videos so that people can do some searches and find information? And we'll provide, when we make this episode live, we'll tag you on all of your online spaces so people will hear this. But where else can people find you?
I've written a couple pieces for The Hill, which you can find online. I've written for The Daily Northwestern. My topics usually around gender. I stopped writing for them though, because they changed their policy at Northwestern. So you can't use the word biological sex in an op-ed. These are the things we're talking about. Anyway, that's another conversation. So I really stopped writing for the Daily Northwestern. I've written for Quillette. We have another piece coming out with Quillette, which is an amazing publication. I love them. We've done some work with the Center for Male Psychology, but the future, I don't know. I mean, we've got a lot. I know The Hill, we're going to keep writing for The Hill. And basically, find me online if you hear this and you want us to add something to your conversation, because we would love to do more writing. My writing partner, Forrest Rahm, and I have really bonded over this professionally, and we see this going in a really great place. We want to share this information with anybody who's willing to take it seriously and hear us out and have an open dialogue. So the website, psychforum.com, is where our base will be. Our Substack is coming out in October, so we'll be writing there probably at least once a month, probably more. And yeah, so look for us online. We're just anyone who will let us have a voice. We're not saying no. We're saying yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so happy that you have Forrest, because like in life, I think in business, it's hopeful and useful to have a partner so that it's not all on you and you have that person you can bounce ideas off of, but it will also has your back when things might go a little haywire. So that's really wonderful that you're not having to shoulder all of this. I mean, I know I'm quite heterodox myself, and so I'm often referred to as a transphobe, even though I'm a trans man, and I sort of let it go in one ear and out the other, but I wish it weren't happening.
Right.
But, you know, thankfully I have a spouse, a wife, 23 years, and I have my person, right? And so you professionally, you have your person. I'm glad.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, Kevin, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the listener has. And I look forward to seeing what you do next as Psych Form develops and expands. And I'm really looking forward to that. So thank you for taking the initiative to do something rather than just sit back and complain about it or hide away from it. Thank you for doing something. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We've reached the end of the Umbrella Hour. You were listening to Xander Keg and his guest, Kevin Waldman, founder of PsychForm. You can check Kevin out on his social media accounts, Instagram at the Kevin Waldman, or X at Kev Waldman, or LinkedIn at Kevin-Waldman-numero131-alpha-A-5-alpha-A-numero-18-alpha-B. Until next time, thank you for listening.